Welcome to Building Sustainability, the podcast that brings you interviews with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. I'm your host, Jeffrey Hart.
Hello, and welcome back to Building Sustainability. This is part two of a conversation with Emily Reynolds. If you are coming straight in here, then maybe head to part one first. It's a bit more of an introduction. This one gets a bit more geeky and a bit more in depth. We talk about posture, trowel technique, fermentation, lots about fermentation. We talk about floors, we talk about lime plaster. And I think there's lots of really fascinating cultural notes that come out of this conversation. Just before the episode, just want to say, if you are enjoying this podcast and you want to support it, head on over to the Patreon site. There are now enough supporters that the podcast is paying its own way in terms of outgoings for hosting and websites and all that sort of stuff. So thank you to everyone that's supporting. And if you haven't checked it out already, you can head on over there and there's extra bits, extra interviews, and chance to add in your questions to the upcoming guests. Okay, enjoy the episode. See you at the end.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I was watching one of the videos on your blog last night, and one of the things I really noticed was the posture, how everyone had incredible posture. And and I'm thinking about, you know, how I don't see very many 70-year-old plasterers in this country. And I think, I think the looking after your body is massively neglected. Do you think that's a fair?
Yeah, it might be. But I'll tell you one thing. I don't think it's conscious.
Right.
The looking after your body thing. And I think that the older folks here have it easier than the younger, because it's a sit on the floor culture. And so it's also like squatty potty culture, right? So from a younger age, people are using their knees more. People are using, not in this like cushy furniture. Nowadays, people are in cushy furniture. And so you get, you know, younger people in their 20s, 30s, 40s who are like, oh, my lower back, and they complain. But the older folks, like, you don't hear them complain that much, come to think of it. They just keep going. Or they like bore through the pain. They're just like, of course I'm in pain. Duh. You know?
I'm alive. Of course I'm in pain.
Yeah. Yeah. But their posture is very good. And I would attribute it to just the floor sitting culture, actually, more than anything else, maybe. Yeah.
One thing I particularly noticed was when people were plastering a wall, it was the sort of lateral movement that came from their legs rather than a twisting motion.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're gonna face your surface dead on, and you're not gonna succeed in making a flat wall unless you keep your trowel in front of your body. And so you move your body to keep that trowel there, and also keep a very loose wrist. That part's really hard for me, because I didn't keep that in my mind when I first got my training and then went through my 8 years of switch off. No master. And it's a hard habit to get your body to go into once you start being like, oh, material stiff, brace the shoulder, brace the elbow, brace the wrist. It's not that. Everything is very, very soft. And so, there is that. And that's the other beauty of being in these longer trainings, because those very minute adjustments that you do with your body and your movement and your wrist and your elbow and how it all works together. That's why it takes so long to learn it, because there's so many little parts that you have to think about at first, but then you have to let those things fall into your subconscious and all work together. And that's kind of why they recommend starting young.
Well, you're still mentally supple and able to absorb it all.
Exactly. Yeah. And take orders.
Just do what you're told, and you'll be thankful for it in 70 years time.
Exactly.
Well, maybe not that long, but
you'll look back and you'll be thankful. Yeah. So I noticed that you just signed in to the Japanese Plastercraft Facebook page.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you found it, which is
great. Well, I'd actually been on there before, and then I deleted Facebook, and so it had gone. Oh. And I've just come back again. So.
Okay. You're cleaning up the Facebook act.
I am, yes. I now have a business profile, which, no friends. Oh. interesting groups.
Oh, cool. That's fun. Yeah. Okay. So then you've been familiar with it for a while then. Something I wanted to do while I was in the States, or it occurred to me would be great, would be to have interviews, because we can do that on Facebook, is, have these live interviews and people can watch them live or watch them after they've been recorded. And with the various, masters that are on there, cause there's really incredible plasterers that have join that site. I'm so thankful that they've been sharing their amazing knowledge. And then also other members who find posts as they follow different Japanese plasterers that they share with the group. And it's just so amazing to see everything that's gathered there. And it would be wonderful to be able to tap that knowledge a little bit deeper and maybe get, you ask people for questions that they can or that I could ask them and then translate. So if you ever wanted to do something here with that, I could try to coordinate.
Very much
it.
So, yeah. Let's make that happen.
Okay, deal. Please. That was super good.
Excellent. Well, yeah, because I just watched in sort of preparation for chatting to you, I was watching, excuse my pronunciation, Mizugon? Gon?
It was Mizugone. Yeah. Are you familiar with Spanish pronunciation at all?
Not particularly.
Each vowel is pronounced in the same way as Spanish.
Okay.
Mizugone. You pronounce a, e, u, e, o. Those are the only ways that you can say a, e, i, o, u. A, e, e, o, u.
Okay, so hang on. I'm going to give it a go. Mizugone?
You're better. Yeah, Mizugone.
Mizugone.
Yeah. There you go. You got it. Perfect. You're pro.
Excellent. Right. Yeah. Just gonna learn how to do it better now. But I just watched the video that you put up of the learning day, and I learned so much, so many things, which were just little of course moments, like putting a more sandy mix near the edge because of the shrinking.
That's the best. That's my favorite.
I couldn't believe it. It's like, oh, well, obviously, why wouldn't you do that? And certainly I noticed the posture. One of the things that really got me was the size of the trowels around the border. Some of those were, what was going on there? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's important because you want to control that edge. So, and then also, the narrower your bevel is, you're creating walls that are very thin. So that's part of the unique aspect of the Japanese earthen wall, is how thin it is. Like on average, 5-6 centimeters, 50-60 okay. millimeters.
Is that 50-60 millimeters in total thickness, as in?
In total thickness, right. So that's why it looks so conventional, even though it's earth. Because it's got the same conventional width, like from a aesthetic standpoint. And that's because they demand, the aesthetic demands that the posts are revealed on the inside of the house and the outside of the house. And so how thick you can make the wall depends on how big pieces of wood you can get. And so in Kyoto, for example, those walls became thinner and thinner and thinner because it's been the capital for so long, 1,200 years, or, you know, it's been lived in for that long. So all of the larger timber and the surrounding mountains were gone a while ago. And so it was limited, like how large they could make the walls were limited. So there's other parts of the country where you might see 60 millimeters, but here you see around 50. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's a subtle difference, but it's big enough that, you know, the professionals notice the difference.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's so much bigger over here. You know?
So the other thing I picked up from that film, which you sort of talked about a little bit earlier, the final finishing strokes of the person doing that. And there was just the slowest movement. It was really beautiful to watch. Yeah.
It's so beautiful to watch. It's mesmerizing.
I've never seen plastering that slow.
Okay. Now I know which video you're talking about. Yeah. That one where I was like, okay, I'm speeding it up here because... Yeah.
That's it.
And I'm like, this is the actual real speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it had been gone super slow motion, but it was.
I know, but that was the actual speed. Yeah, it's incredible. So what that is, it's that the trowel itself is really heavy, and the layers below are built up so that there's enough water in the final plaster that you have just barely enough time, if you're really, 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 really good, to get like one slow pass over that last film of a finish. It's very, very thin. And what they're doing is, so let me try to get biological here. Or is it physics? I'm not sure if it's biology or physics. There's very fine straw, right? Like almost like dust, but more than, like a little bit more substance than dust. Like, it's very deliberately created straw fibers, length, thickness, created just for that finish. And so you pass, you know, the finest of straw through
Like a mesh, a sieve?
Mesh, thank you. Okay, yeah, I forget English so much. through the mesh, and you get rid of the powdery stuff. And then you kind of divide from there again into larger pieces and smaller pieces. And then you use the smaller pieces for the mizugone. And so what's happening when you're passing this very thick, heavy trowel with super diligent control over that very, very thin application of plaster, you're pushing the clay platelets in while allowing the fine pieces of straw to kind of come to the surface. You don't want to push that straw in, because then it will change the texture of the surface. And the texture of the surface has to be the same in every single part of the wall. If you mess it up, you have to do it again. Like if you accidentally push here a little bit too much, like that's it. You got to do it all over again. So it's a very, very demanding finish. It's probably the hardest.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. It makes what I know as plastering seem like, I don't know, like just throwing mud at a wall. That's.
Well, you know, it's that's what's fun about it, right? Is that there's these places where the knowledge is still around, where it's, yeah, it is throwing mud on the wall, but they're doing it in this way that's so unique, you know?
Yeah.
It's so disciplined. It's very, very disciplined.
Goodness.
It is. And, you know, it's like, does the world need mizugone? I don't know. You know, like, who really needs that finish? But it's fun. But the thing is that it's back when these sort of finishes were being created, it was basically because the plasterers wanted to create the next best thing. And they had these rich clients that wanted them to create something that nobody else had. And, you know, these are people that started training when they were 12, 13. And so by the time they're, you know, 28, 30, they've had a very long, you know, exposure, experience, so many different skills that they've built up over their 15-year career by that point. And they want to show that they're the best. So they want to create something that's nobody else can do, but they can do it and they pull it off. And then people see it and they go, ooh, that's so cool. And they try to do it too. And then they succeed and they're like, I'm going to one-up you. And they do something else that's even harder. And it is, you know, that was present in the culture until probably the early 1900s. So it's not that far in the history. So they say that the Taisho era, which is like 1910, 1914, something around there, was the heyday of plaster skills. And when it's easy to see going to different job sites, because most of the job sites I go to are restorations. There's some new builds, and that's where I was talking about the transition of, you know, getting earth on top of drywall, which is interesting. But even more interesting is when you go to these 100-year-old job sites and you're like, what were they thinking? Why do they make it so hard? You know, like, what are they doing with these details? Like, what is this angle? Like, you have to, like, you know, break something to plaster this little tiny detail, and or create your own trowel to get into that, like, little groove and angle and make it absolutely flat and build up to it. It's incredible. Like, what they were accomplishing back then is absolutely stunning. And, you know, it's near enough in history that some of those skills still flutter around, but those guys that are in their 70s, a lot of them are taking it to their grave. There's luckily a few in the younger generation that will carry the mantle, and thanks to them, it's not disappearing. You know, some people attribute the the government with having programs for cultural heritage sites and such that demand these traditional skills are used in order to do every restoration on the shrines or the temples or the castles, whatever it might be. A lot of times those rules are bent and they end up using some synthetic material and it's never the same. So it's not the government that's helping carry the tradition. It feels like almost the excitement of the accomplishment, yeah. You know, doing something so hard and doing it and like showing other people that you did it, you know, and that's what's cool about this social media bit that comes in is that they're egging each other on. Every time these guys put a post on their Facebook page, they're showing their buddies around Japan, like, look what I did. You know, and their buddies are going, how'd you do that? Or that's awesome. I'm going to do one up better. You know,
like, yeah. It's this one-upmanship that's just elevating the craft.
Yeah, it's a very healthy competition, and they're good people. Like, there's something about like you people that work with Earth that are just very fun and nice to work with. So people feel that over here too.
Excellent. With the restoration, is it do you need to do a like for like? Is that the sort of culture for restoration?
Yes. So there's different ways of thinking about that too. And sadly, it's rarely the plasterer's decision. Mm-hmm. If the plasterer has a direct relationship with the client, like Miyaoku-san is somebody who works in that way, and he often posts onto the Japanese plaster craft, and you know his realm of buddies and plasterers. I think a lot of them have that relationship too. It's a direct relationship with the client, so they have a little more say in how things are done. Like the client just says, "You do it," because we know you know best. But sadly in Kyoto, it becomes this academic versus practitioner thing where we're told what to do and we do it by people. And the people who are telling us what to do don't always know what is best. Sometimes what they tell us inevitably fails. And then they consult the plasterer and say, what should we do? And then, of course, the plaster master knows how to make it right.
It sounds familiar.
Except
for the plaster master bit. I don't feel like we've got too many of those.
They're around, I'm sure. And then you also like run down to the individual. You know, some people don't see a problem with slapping up an acrylic over earth in order to, you know, stay any kind of like keep the water moisture from getting back into the substrate below there. Other people say, now you've kind of messed up the whole function of the earth wall. You need to do it without that acrylic. But again, it's kind of whoever's the boss on the job site is going to make the decision, or your boss does, or your boss tells you, like, this is how I want you to do it. And so that's how you do it. Every job site is different. The process at every single site, it's almost like there is no formula for any given finish, because each time you come onto a job site, the conditions are going to be different. And so you have to adjust to what you have. Especially with restorations, I'm sure you've experienced, like, you don't know what you're getting into until you're already halfway into it. If you're lucky, like, then you're like, okay, now I know what to do. Like, now that you've removed whatever's failing, and until you take off that surface, you don't know how deep you need to go. And that's also a trick too, like learning how much is just the right amount to remove. Not too much, not too little. That's also a really fun part of the training, I feel, is getting a sense and a feel for all of that, so that you can be confident when you go to a new job site that's going to have its own challenges and its own unique set of conditions that you have to deal with, and you know, just know that you can do it anyway. That's one thing that's really fun about like New Mexico area of the U.S. There's a lot of Adobe houses, and like that's perfect for me. I love that. Like, that's my realm, because I know how to deal with that. Like, I know how to bring those back to beauty, because it's not so different from what's in Japan. You know, we take off what's failing and build it back up so that it keeps for another however many decades. And yeah, that's I love that. Earth is so universal in that way.
Well, I want to talk about fermenting. That's
okay.
The big thing in my world at the moment. I've actually just yesterday set a big bin of straw to ferment. I mean, I'm playing around. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm really intrigued to learn more about what it is. How are you fermenting? How are you sort of working that into your plasters?
So I heard you and Will talking about like just soaking the straw in water by itself. And what was funny to me listening to that is that I thought of the same thing when I first went back to the US. I was like, oh, well, why not just go ahead and soak the straw? They don't do that here. And I don't know if there's a reason. And if I started asking around, I'm curious if I would get a reason or if I just get like, I don't know. What do we do? You know, but some people might say like there might be an actual chemical shift that's happening, or bacteria that are growing when you put the straw together with the earth versus just letting the straw sit in water. So what I guess the point of doing that would be hoping that the straw softens faster.
Yeah, softens, breaks down, and kind of gets that gluey quality.
And it feels like the doing that in just water is a quicker process than doing that together with the clay.
It's purely practical for me, in that I am doing a job in, you know, another part of the country where my materials, my sand and my clay are being sent. I've got the straw with me to mix up all the plaster and then ship it over there. It's a more difficult thing to achieve.
I see. All your materials aren't together and you can't like load up all this heavy mud and take it with you.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's tricky. And will you pour off the water before you
take? I was thinking of using the water. It feels like that's going to contain a lot of the bits I want, but I'm not, you know, I am very much feeling my way. What would you think about that?
I feel like I want to ask my current master, because he actually did a study together with the university to find out what bacteria exactly are growing in this fermented plaster. And is there something about that bacteria that's contributing to the qualities, the good qualities that we find when we do the fermentation? So I feel the same as you, that there's something in the water that you don't want to lose, you know? But I also know that part of our process when we're creating this plaster, you know, we put the cut straw into the mud with the water, mix it around, let it sit, go back, mix it around again, add more straw. So, and as you're doing that mixing around motion, you're also breaking apart those fibers further into the mud And you don't get the chance to do that if you have your straw sitting separately from your clay and then you add it. Like it doesn't have that.
It's added and then it's mixed. So.
Right. But that timing, that friction between the earth and the straw breaking apart this one piece, I think one of poetic ways of saying it is like this one piece of straw breaks into 10,000 little pieces of hair, that sort of process might not happen as readily as if it was already inside this mix where there's that friction happening, breaking it apart, physically. But, I did the same thing, and I can't remember why. Was it just because I didn't have sifted earth to add to it? I did this thing where, what kind of straw are you using?
Barley.
Barley straw. Okay. Because, Japan is rice. And in the U.S., I've used, oat and wheat. That's very common. And it's so much stiffer. So, and it also gives off a different color. And so I was somehow had wheat straw and then also had rice straw. And I wanted to know what's the difference, with the same exact water, the same exact earth, what different, material will I get? And I did not stick around long enough to find out the end result of my experiment.
Oh, the cliffhanger.
I know, such a bummer. But so I have yet to learn the answer to that question. I think just in logical thinking of my own logic, which probably isn't that logical, I would probably do the same thing you're doing. Just go ahead and soak it, because softening it has to be better than not softening it. I imagine barley is a rather stiff fiber.
It's less stiff than wheat. It's definitely softer. Yes. And I spoke to, one of my episodes is with Judith Thornton, and she tests plant materials for insulation. And we were talking specifically about building straw bale buildings. And she said, if you're building with barley, don't, if it gets slightly wet, it's going to decompose. So my thinking was, I want it to break down. So I've gone for the sort of less rigid straw type.
I see. Yeah, that was a good hint. That was nice. If it gets wet, it's going to break down. Yeah. Want that for this, don't want that for that. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well, I'm curious to know how that turns out. When is your project?
It's in a couple of weeks. So.
Okay.
I guess that leads on to my next question is fermenting times. How long are you leaving these things to ferment?
It depends on the time of year. So if it's summer, you could get away with a couple weeks, but originally, I heard you want to do it for 2 years. 6 months up to 2 years, over winter. There's something about that, freeze and thaw process, too, that helps break things down really nicely. I don't know how much I trust this one. This is also my current master and his... another experiment that he did at the same uni that was about this exact question. So if you have a plaster, what's the compressive strength of that plaster when it's been fermented 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month? I think that was the time frame. And found that it sort of peaked in strength at 2 weeks. And I'm a little bit dubious. I don't know why, because to really find out if the conventional wisdom is true or not, you need to have that 2 year fermented stuff. The constraints of university study doesn't really allow for that. And you can't guarantee that you've got the same straw, the same earth, working in those same, conditions. So it makes it harder to test in that way. But yeah, I feel like there must be a reason why conventional wisdom said up to 2 years. Like in the summertime, maybe like 2 months, but then up to 2 years. And then there's something about like after 2 years, it starts to get weaker. And that's the conventional wisdom that I heard at the beginning. So yeah, it's another one of these, like there's no answer. Nobody can tell you.
Excellent. Well, I'll just keep feeling my way around.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you're starting with a different straw too. So what can I possibly know? It's got different qualities then, rice. Very yeah. Fascinating. Yeah.
So you were saying that you add in straw and leave it for a while, and then you're adding in more. Mm-hmm. And what sort of time period is that leaving it for a while on that first time, and then how long until you're using it again?
Tequito.
It depends.
Yeah.
Is that your version of it depends?
It depends, tequito. It means like totally random.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and like when you're told to. Okay. It'll depend on like when is the job. You know, when do you need to have this plaster ready? You know, and then right before you use it, you might add some finer chopped straw to get like the smaller rebarbs or whatever, you know, equivalent mm-hmm. into the mix as well. Like not only the 10 centimeter pieces, you know, 5 to 10 centimeter pieces, but also like 2 centimeter ones too. Yeah, it's all feel. Like once you get to the job site, you adjust it again to what you want to work with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, the boss might look at the plaster that's fermenting and see that it needs more straw, you know, or he might feel it, or he might poke it with a stick or with a hoe and then tell us to add more straw. And most of the time won't say how much. We're supposed to intuit it after we work with somebody and do it like once or twice. And then if you're like me, you get really nervous about that. And you know, after you think you have enough in there, you plop it on a hawk, and then you go to one of your mentors and say, is this okay? And they tell you yes or no, or they tell you like, quit asking me, or... Yeah, tequito, very random.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Brilliant. I like that a lot. Well, I guess continuing on from the fermenting, what sort of anecdotally, what do you think the difference in, well, sort of not fermenting and fermenting a little bit in a long time? How do they feel in terms of application?
So as far as feel goes, there's probably three different ways to answer that question. And by feel, it's slicker. More of the gluten of the straw has come out into the earth, or like the bacteria or whatever it is that allows for this sort of slimy glide to happen. It's not really slimy, but you know what I mean. And so in that sense, because it's still hefty, it's got the straw, it just moves easier. You're able to work it much easier. The workability is better. The other aspect to it is that it's ultimately more water resistant. And Will was talking about that too. That was the part that was really exciting to hear about. You know, like, oh, that's universal too. Cool. And then the other bit, and that he actually like took a hose to it for like a super long time, right?
Yeah.
It's so awesome to hear about. I think that's perfect geekiness.
He's been working at the brickyard for a couple of years now, and they've essentially given him free rein to potter around in this massive shed and just conduct fun clay-based experiments. It's a joy. I've been to visit quite a few times, and he's just like, oh, look at this thing I'm doing. You know, look at this. And I've got my lab over here. And
wow, that is so fortunate. And it's so cool that, you know, he has a platform like this in his own, too, to share all that he's learning there. That's, yeah, this is all the things I need to learn out in the world, in the great, great world.
Yeah.
And so the third aspect is actually compressive strength. It actually does become stronger, like the university experiment, which, you know, who would ever do that? But my master is kind of a different sort of bloke. So he did it. and there was somebody also geeky enough to want to know the answer, that obliged that experiment. And found that when you ferment it, it has better compressive strength. It is actually, you know, architecturally stronger to ferment it. So there's multiple benefits that apparently happen when you ferment.
Yeah.
Not to mention the amazing smell.
You like the smell, do you?
Oh, it's the best aroma. That's how I knew that I was in the right place when in 2007, when I walked into the doors of the Plaster Academy in Kyoto. It's a 5-story, very narrow building, and the first classrooms aren't until the third floor, but you walk into the front, like, sliding doors, and, like, the whole smell just comes at you. I was like, I have arrived. I knew I was in the right place. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
It's I'm kind of intrigued to know how it's going to go down on it's a very conventional build that I'm putting a floor into. And we're the sort of quirky mud installers going into that. So I'm intrigued to know how the other workers are going to take to the aroma.
I see. Yeah. That will be very fun.
We'll see.
Yes.
So I was talking to, he was actually one of my first building students this morning. And he's been working with Will. And so he's been down this little rabbit hole of fermenting. And he was saying that he's been thinking about starter cultures and using a little bit of already fermented straw to start the next batch.
Yes. That's absolutely something that happens, and it'll happen much faster. It's rare that you use up your entire stash of plaster, like, for it to, like, end magically perfectly. And it's precious material, whatever's left over. Like, it took a while for it to reach that point. So yeah, it does become the seed, the starter culture for your next batch. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Excellent. Okay, well, that's good tip. I wish I'd known that maybe 2 weeks ago, but that's okay. No.
Now you know.
And then that's it. That's what this podcast is all about.
That special aroma, you'll get it so much quicker.
Oh, yes.
Enjoy. Well, because you asked me about the bevel, that sandy bevel, and like why the trowel is so small, and I got off to another tangent and never quite answered that. So there's the shape, right? The shape of it is very nice for doing a small bevel, but also so you have more control, and the amount of area that has pressure to compress that small area is greater. So the smaller the trowel, the more compression you get for just that exact place where you want it. That's all.
Uh-huh. So around the edge, you want that nice tight compression.
You do. So when you apply it, you don't necessarily need to put a lot of strength into it. You kind of do. And where you put the strength, it's very interesting. Where you put the strength is at the butt of the trowel. So where the trowel, you don't want to cut into your wood. If you cut into your wood, the carpenter's going to be pissed off. Because that is essentially your finish line, right? Like you're creating your finish line at the point where that bevel meets your wooden frame. And you are going to have a much easier time plastering, like filling in the area inside the wall, if your line, your mud-to-mud line, is very clean and straight. There's something really nice about having a everything being the same, like having a line where it's all equal amounts of plaster going over every single part of that edge. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're having
sort of uniformity. Is that what you're...
Uniformity. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Having a uniform amount of work that you need to do in every single part helps you to just do everything much faster and get your job done in a timely way where you're not losing to moisture being pulled away. You don't have to fuss. There's a reason for that nice clean line beyond just aesthetics. It's also very beautiful. And the plus side of that is that whoever walks on your job site is going to be like, ooh, it's pretty, you know, and then you make a good name for your boss and you've done something good. But it's also functional. It also makes your job easier. So everything you do is to make the next step easier. And that trowel being that small allows you the pressure to just make that bevel the exact shape and size that you need it to be for the next step to be easier. And you put a little bit of pressure up on the butt of the trowel as you plaster when you're doing the application. And you'll apply, like, depending on how much thickness you need to go to get to that. Because you make like a chalk line or whatever. You make a line on the wood for, you know, where you want to plaster to. And the edge of the trowel will go lightly against that line, you know, have it just over it or something like that. And then you'll have a little bit of pressure on the bottom butt side of the trowel to make that flat edge where it meets the plaster, the base coat plaster. And then after it gets maybe like some moments before leather hard, you go back and you actually put pressure on. And so you're really making like a compression action at that point. Which I think the reason for that is to make sure that you have an even line bevel. So you don't have any undulation and you can tell that your line against the wood is correctly flat. Because once you put a little bit of pressure, if you have any low spots, you can find them. You know, there's a feel. I don't have it, but there is a feel.
Rebecca calls it using the force. You know, she closes her eyes. And, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, dip there.
Wow. Turns off the lights and plasters in the dark.
Exactly.
Wow.
That's it.
That's amazing. I can't wait to work with her.
It's really interesting you saying about that. I mean, it's evolving my idea of plastering quite a lot because I'm conscious of smaller trowel, more pressure, more, you know, you can push, but I've never considered it in terms of where on the wall I'm plastering. It's always been about which coat. So, you know, if I'm doing, say, plastering onto an uneven sort of straw bale wall, I want to be using a smaller trowel where I can apply more pressure and get into the holes.
Yes.
You know, getting bigger.
Yes.
In trowel size as I sort of come out to the finish coat.
Nice.
But yeah, never different parts of the wall.
Yeah, so many possibilities.
Yeah, I'm going to need more trowels.
Oh, yeah. Can't have too few.
Actually, that's...
Or too many. I can't speak English.
So one of Will's questions. He was so excited when he knew we were going to be talking. He said, how many Japanese trowels are essential for your toolkit? There are so many, and is it really necessary to have them all? What if you could have like a go-to kit?
Okay. When I started learning at the Plaster Guild, there was four. There was four that they provided you. And so there was the 150, the 150 millimeters, jigane, so the iron. And the 210 iron and Yanagiba. Yanagiba is like that triangular one. So it's sort of like a triangular shape, like pointy at the top. And that's really nice for a variety of things. You can use it for the bevel, but it's a little harder to wield and manipulate. But it's also good for, gosh, use it in so many things. So that one and also the kimeguri, which is the, it kind of looks like a skinny bamboo leaf, but it's longer and narrower. Those four are what they provided us at the school. And yeah, those are essential. Yeah. And beyond that, it's very much what sort of buildings are you working on? So, you know, part of the reason why we need so many in Japan is that, like, we're working on covering rafters. We're working on covering these spaces that go in from the rafters. And so we need smaller, or like inside closets and like smaller panel. Or, you know, there's all these different little details that fancy carpenters like to make, and we just have to make their work look pretty, right? So, so we have to, you know, acquire our tools accordingly. But yeah, those four are essential, and you know, the 150 is nice because it's on the smaller end. And then the 210 is nice because it's on the larger end. But if you're a big person and you're going over a large area, then you might want to scale up to like a 280. Usually they go up in, or the 270, like 15 millimeter increments is how they're sold.
Okay.
So like 180, 185, 210, and on and on. You don't really see beyond 300 very much because it's not practical. For stainless ones, then yeah, like having 270s, 300s can be good because the stainless ones, they're thin, right? They're meant to go over thinner applications. And so, but also flat, like the whole aesthetic that's used in Japan that those things are designed for is flat. So if you're going over something with even a little bit of undulation, you might want to go for a smaller trowel than, say, a 300 because you're gonna find that you miss a lot of places. Unless, you know, having a varied texture on the wall is just perfect. Then you don't have to worry about that. But and you can, you know, go faster over whatever big wall. Walls in Western design are so much bigger than walls in Japanese design. So yeah, what sort of job site you're working on is really gonna determine, you know, what set you want to have.
Yeah, yeah. I think I was thinking about the trowels that we have, and you know, our large trowels are they're getting pretty huge, yeah. Certainly in the sort of conventional end.
Yeah. It has to be so hard to hold.
Yeah, and your wrist. It's so much pressure on your wrist.
And it's that It's that one where like you hold the trowel and then the part that connects to the like the plane that you're moving the mud with, it's up at the top of the trowel or the top of the handle, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's like, yeah, I've deliberately avoided those because I heard they're horrible on the wrist.
Yes, it's certainly strenuous. And I know quite a lot of plasterers who have always got some sort of support or, that might be a sort of more cultural way of, putting as much on the trowel and trying to really get it on the wall as quickly as possible.
Well, trying to make a beautiful product, a beautiful wall. Yeah.
Okay, I've got another Will question for you. Hang on.
Okay.
So we've talked about this a little bit more, but perhaps, well, he said, here we have learned that to really compress clay plasters at every stage. So making sure that you're floating, burnishing, to make them more resilient against abrasion and knocks. But from his viewpoint, it seems that the Japanese don't do this compression
ever.
And he'd wondered if that is because the clay plaster recipe is better, or is it a cultural difference that we treat our plasters maybe less well and we bump against them, whereas it's...
That's very interesting. I don't know the whys. I don't know the reasons why, I remember I did get to work with a Japanese master in the U.S. on it was like a Japanese carpentry job site, and so I went to be his support, and it was wonderful because I got to learn from him. And so at the same time, on the weekends, another favorite crew of that carpenter would come on, and he would bring like the foreman of that crew. He'd bring like, four or five of his guys, and they'd just come for the weekends just to earn some extra money. And they really liked working on these projects. And, I would just like watch in awe because they would finish so quickly. And yet Naito-san would tell me, for what we're doing, you plaster better than they do. And I couldn't understand why. And he said, look at the surface of their finished product. It's so compact. It's hard. It's harsh on the senses. It needs to be softer. Like he's fuwatto shiteru. Fuwatto. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess mine has more fuwa than these, guys that are like at it and they're like, whoa, and they're done, And I'm like, wow, they're it's beautiful to watch them work. But I guess from his point of view, they have the habit of compressing. That's what you do. Like that is how you plaster. You use strength and you push and you're done. And that's not how you do. And like it's a soft touch. Even though what we were plastering was synthetic, is this stuff called Julux, and it's weird because it's meant to look like traditional earthen plaster, but it's got the glues in it, and it's fake. But you can put it over conventional materials; it holds up better. But still, according to Naito-san, when you plaster it, it's a soft touch. It doesn't change from how you would plaster with earth. So it could also be that as just a butsuriteki, so physical physics, at a physics level. If you compress at each stage with earth, then when you go to put the next layer up, you're layering on top of something that's not going to adhere so well. Your next layer isn't going to adhere so well to that compressed layer underneath. So if you leave it porous, if you leave each layer porous, then the next time that you plaster over it, you're going to have a better,
a key.
Yeah. Very, very subtle. Very, very, very subtle, but very, very real. And also you will have a longer working time, because since it's porous, when you go to wet it, you're going to get more water going into those pores, and that's going to help you achieve the next layer more beautifully, because you'll have a little bit more working time, and that means so much when it's so freaking hot outside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are reasons. There are actual reasons now that I try to think about it.
That's interesting. So one thing that Will and I have done with a backing coat, a base coat, is that we're compressing it with a sponge float, so which leaves a very open surface. So there is definitely a consciousness not to close up that surface and make it, you know, very smooth.
Yeah, you've had those experiences too.
But still wanting to push on that plaster and compress it.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think there's that feeling like you need to do that?
So the way that we've been thinking about it is that if you have a more clay-rich plaster, it ends up being stronger. But it needs to be compressed more to stop it pulling apart as it dries. And maybe
pulling
we're just thinking
from
about
itself?
It. Yeah, so cracking.
Okay.
But I think now I'm learning more about sort of the glueyness of a fermented plaster. Maybe I'm starting to change my thoughts on that.
And are you favoring doing the fermenting plaster as a base layer, or is that your final layer?
Do you know what? I've actually only done it in floors, so it says a final.
That's right. You're saying floors, and that's the only place that you've done it.
So far, I should
so
add.
So far. That's fascinating, because there's an earthen floor method called tataki in Japan, and it's lime, magnesium. I'm gonna say the wrong word. It's whatever left in seawater, ocean water, after you take out the salt. So that's okay. Nigari. And it's the same thing that they use for solidifying tofu.
Really?
Yeah. There's like edible version and then non-edible version. And like the construction world gets the non-edible version. Magnesium sulfate? I don't think it's chloride. I think it's magnesium sulfate. So lime, earth, and that. And then they compress. It's not fermented, but I'm intrigued by this idea of, I haven't done a lot of earthen floors, like as in probably like zero. So I, without any experience, but hearing a lot about it, it's sort of intriguing to think about, do you find that you end up with something that you're more satisfied with about the final product?
Yes. Yeah. Certainly in application, it's a more pleasant thing. It's that sort of suppleness. It's almost, it's not a very nice word, sort of mucousy. It's, yes. And it does seem that it's stronger as well, which is, what you're saying.
Desirable. And then also that makes sense that you're compressing because it's a floor, and then also that you don't want at that if that is that your finish then, like that's
yes,
that's the whole thing. Okay, so yeah, then of course you don't want any cracks in there, and if it's clay rich, then that makes perfect sense that you would need to do that compressing for that. Yeah, with tataki too, like it's a it's kind of a play on words. It means to hit, tataku. But then also they use Chinese characters at their own leisure. Like nothing makes sense. So it's like you write the Chinese characters for three and then peace, and then earth, and read it tataki. And there's like nowhere else in any other word in all of Japan land that reads any of those characters in that way. But I guess because there's three ingredients in harmony and it's based on earth or it's on the ground, then they call it tataki. And then you're hitting it, so they call it tataki. Yeah,
I was asked to potentially try and do one of those floors. So oh. I did some research. It was interesting. It's a much drier mix and sort of beaten down, isn't it?
Yes.
And I think, is it traditionally left under bamboo leaves to keep the moisture in?
Oh, that's news to me.
Oh, that's what I'd read. Maybe
we, well, maybe that was back in the fancy days. We use plastic sheets now.
Life's moved on.
Well, you know, we just get crasser.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think like there's something about curing it slowly, which you don't see in any other part of the earthen building process in Japan. Like we don't do slow cures for example, for the lime finish. Like that's sometimes like on hot. Actually, am I lying? I don't think I am, because even in hot times like this, if we had to do a restoration and do, you know, that thin lime plaster, no, we wouldn't be going back and spraying it down and hoping that it cures slower. We wouldn't be. It's not necessary for whatever reason. And I don't know if that's because of the inclusion of the seaweed glue. Kind of makes that a non-issue. Or if it's a thinness, yeah. Very, very thin application. But for the floor, that's different. For the floor, they do, like, you do need to go back and wet it down and let it cure slowly. Maybe it's just because of the thickness or because it gets walked on, like a different set of needs, a different set of demands that you're putting on the material.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Oh. I find it fascinating what you just said about the lime plaster. So that's Tsunabai?
Okay, Tsunabai. Yeah, Tsunabai is that's usually used to build up thickness. It's not the finish.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, hang on. So you mean Asagi Shikoi?
I mean Shikri. Yeah. I mean Shikri. Yeah. So Asagi is a blue clay.
So yes, of course.
So
yes.
Asagi Shikri is the white lime Shikri with a little bit of blue clay in it to give it that hue. Yeah.
So the Shikri, that's lime and seaweed, and is it hemp fibers?
Hemp fibers, yeah.
And so that's your sort of finish coat, like an external finish coat?
It is, yeah. And you can do it on the inside too, but usually if you're doing it on the inside, if you're a temple, but more and more houses want it as well, just because it's, you know, I guess it looks like white paint, but it's natural.
Yeah, yeah. And what sort of lime are you using in that? This is getting really geeky.
Oh man, I am the wrong person to ask that question, but I know the right people that get really geeky about it, like from that mountain, no from that prefecture, no from there, you know, like they each person has their own favorite source. And you know, for example, at the company where I work, we use a mixture of limestone powder and shell lime powder. For some reason having that shell lime powder in with the mix is, if they found to be desirable, you know, my master has found that to be what works on pretty much every job site. Now, something that started to become kind of a topic of conversation in the last couple of years is that the lime producers are also changing generations. And so actually it's Miyaoku-san was really talking about it. He's the one that posts a lot on that Japanese plaster craft group. And he's in Nara Prefecture, and he's been making his own lime for his whole plastering career. And it's just these last couple of years that even though he's using the same exact recipe, it's not coming out the same. So what's changed? You know, is it the water? It's not the hemp fibers. You know, don't think it's the seaweed, the quality of the ocean. It seems to be that, which, you know, is an interesting thought. It's like,
there's a lot of pollution.
There is, you know, who knows what all those butterfly effects are. You know, he's pretty convinced, and I've heard other people say the same, that the lime is being produced just enough differently that their go-to tried and true recipes aren't working and they're having to readjust. And that's a bummer. Yeah, so I can't answer your question. That was a long way to say it.
No, that's fine. You gave way more in that answer than just saying we use this. Yeah. That's really fascinating that you know, gentle sort of knock-on effect. I wonder how differently they're making it that's upset this craftsperson's tried and tested.
Yeah, like the burning temperature might be different, or the amount of time they're burning might be different. The amount they're burning compared to the temperature and time might be different. The change of hand.
I wonder if they just switched fuels or something like that. That altered all of those things.
I wonder.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's something that people are observing across all companies. And it's also kind of going back to that heritage tradition. One of the bosses I worked with here, his viewpoint is just so spectacular to me. He says it's not restoration unless you're using the same materials. And that means sourcing those materials from the place that they came from at the time that they were first used. Now, that's a really tall order, because those mines and sites are gone in most cases. But when you can get that material, he said it's really, really important that you, one, support that mine site, because they've definitely lost, especially with lime, they've definitely lost clientele and are struggling. And if you're really trying to, you know, keep the right color, keep the right hue, keep the right texture, then you need, and your restoration job demands that, like, it's a World Heritage site, then of course you need to keep it looking the exact same that it did at its original. That's the material that you need to be using. I'm fascinated by that way of thinking about it, and it's like, well, but of course, you know? that makes absolute sense.
You get down there and start mining some out yourself if they've closed for business.
It's gotta be
the right.
Send the new hirees to go out and dig, and then pulverize all day long. That's what the young ones are for.
Yeah, that's it. That's why you get them so young.
That's right.
That's wonderful. I mean, I feel like I've taken up a lot of your time.
Likewise. I need to plug my computer in.
I just wondered if there was anything that you wanted specifically to talk about.
I wanted to talk about the old guys. I covered them. Oh, the new guys. Let's talk about the newer generation too, because that's what I wanted to touch on in the book that I produced last year, which I self-published that, not through Amazon, because I have a wicked hatred for Amazon. I don't have anything against other people who use it. Everybody has their own choice, but I didn't want to use them again. And even though I'm eternally grateful for the platform that they gave my book, I didn't have to think about it. Like, it just went on its own way. That first one. So what I did last year was self-published, and I only made, you know, so many copies. hopefully I'll find an actual publisher that can set it out. And I'm waiting to hear back, but Corona time has put everything on a dawdle pace. But so what I wanted to show in that book was that this is very much a craft that has a future. There are people in younger generations. Like, I made a point of focusing on people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s that are doing this craft. And also, it's mostly a picture book because I wanted to show the job sites, the conditions of the job sites, and the posture. It's one of those, like, the longer you look at it, the more you see sort of things. If you're a craftsperson, I think if you're an academic, you might not, you know, catch all that as much, which I learned, you know, from that first publishing, that it was people who are, you know, handy that really were like, oh, what's happening here? You know, and that was really fun to witness. So I really want people to know that utilize social media to learn more about this craft. Like, there's so much more out there that even I realize. Like, I love that Facebook group because I learn so much, you know, through other people that are, you know, keying into what all information is out there, what other posts people are putting out there. Thanks to that information, like, it's not going to go anywhere. You know, like, the younger generations are interested. They do see the value. And as we share at a global level, the value of these natural materials, like, it's not just, you know, just because it's this material, there's a meaning behind it. There's a thought process about longevity of the building and also humanity in the choices that are being made for these materials. As Japanese start to understand that piece and the value of their craft in that framework, they're going to start honoring their tradition even more, I feel. So it's kind of happened with macrobiotic food. It's a born in Japan thing, but it wasn't until Madonna got a macrobiotic chef that it ever became a word that people in Japan know. No one in Japan knew about it until Madonna was like, I have a macrobiotic chef. And they're like, ooh, macrobiotics, Japanese. And this is reverse export, import, reverse import. And I really believe that this craft can follow that pattern.
So we need Madonna to plaster her house and play. Is that enough?
Absolutely. Get Miyaoka-san and, like, the other people to get out there. Send his crew that worked on the 5-tier pagoda at Yakushiji to go plaster house for Madonna. Then everything will be set right.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much. I've had like the most wonderful time.
Me too. Yeah, this is like, I can't believe we have been talking for so long. We have. Yeah. I can't wait to go back through your archives and learn so much more and from here on too. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Emily. That was genuinely an absolute joy. I feel like my understanding of plastering has just significantly leveled up. And yeah, I've got 100 more questions that I could ask you. There'll be links for various stuff. I'll get them up on the website as soon as possible. Do check back if they're not up instantly. I'm kind of committed to getting this out on Monday morning. But I'm also committed to having some sleep. So I will probably do that. Okay. No more ramble. Until next time. See you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.